Going in our Bibles then to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7 is where we're going to be this morning. And we'll find that Jesus is going to the regions beyond. This is the only passage or the only portion of Scripture where we find Jesus going beyond Palestine, other than when he was born and Joseph brought them down to Egypt by the Father's command and then brought them back. During the lifetime ministry of Jesus, this is the only time that he leaves Palestine to minister in a different region. Mark chapter 7, we'll begin in verse 24, and we're going to read down through chapter 8, verse 10. I've got the references wrong up there on the screen. 7 through 24 down through 8, 10. Mark 7, verse 24, the Bible says, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.' And she went home and found the child lying in bed, and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee." Now, if you're just for a second, pause for a minute. Tyre is on the coast on the Mediterranean Sea, and then Sidon is actually north of Tyre, and so he comes from Tyre up to Sidon and then inland and then down to the Sea of Galilee. So get that in your head. He goes even deeper into Gentile territory. Verse 31, "He returned from the region of Tyre, went up through Sidon, then down to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis." So he's on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. "And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged Jesus to lay his hand on the man. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'be opened.' And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, 'He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak.' In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, 'I have compassion on the crowd, because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. Some of them have come from far away.' And his disciples answered him, 'How can one feed these people with bread here in the desolate place?' And he asked them, 'How many loaves do you have?' They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. They had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha." As we've been looking at Jesus and discipleship, we're looking at the book of Mark. He starts out the whole book by saying, "This is the gospel of Jesus Christ." And so as he lays out this good news about Jesus, obviously the book is about Jesus, the person of Jesus. But as Jesus comes on the scene presenting himself, presenting his message there in chapter 1, verse 14. He's preaching the kingdom of God, and he's preaching that men must repent. At the center of his message is the person and the work of Jesus Christ himself. So everywhere we go in Mark, the story is about Jesus. Jesus, as he presents the message from the Father, that the kingdom will be given through him. There's people who respond to Jesus, his work, and his message. And primarily in Mark, we have his work. In other Gospels, we have more of his message. But as Jesus is working and doing and speaking, people are responding to him. And so it's always about Jesus, but it's also about the response to Jesus. There's those who are insiders, those who are outsiders. And so as we look at insiders and outsiders, what it means to be a disciple, at the center of discipleship issue is a question that must be answered. And to help us to try understand this, I've asked this fellow here if he would come and help us answer this question. How do you see yourself? We've seen this picture before. I like this one because it reminds me of a junior high, like a seventh grade guy. I just started working on some exercise program this week. And so you're hurting, you're wondering if it's worth it. Then you go up to the mirror and I think something's happening. To me, this is just like me or a seventh grade guy. You're looking in the mirror and you say, yeah, you know what? I think I got whiskers. Somebody reaches over. Got it. Don't have to worry about that one anymore, right? As we tend to see ourselves, we look through a lens and we look through a perspective on us and we tend to think we're okay. Or maybe we look through the lens and we think, you know what? Everybody's right. Why would anybody like me? God probably doesn't even like me. There's no reason to. As we've just got done with the early part of chapter 7, the Pharisees have come to Jesus and said, listen, your people aren't like our people. We're clean. Your people are unclean. They're looking in a mirror, and they're seeing themselves as all right. They're taking in a deep breath, and they're saying, yeah, I kind of like what I see. Looks pretty good to me. We all tend to view ourselves a little differently than we are. Some too big, some too small. Keller reminds us that there are two ways to fail to let Jesus be your Savior. One is by being too proud, having a superiority complex, not to accept his challenge. The other is through an inferiority complex, being so self-absorbed as not to accept his offer. Why is this question important to the discipleship process? To what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ? To what it means to be a Christian? Isn't it about Jesus? Absolutely, it's about Jesus. But we'll never see Jesus for who he is until we see ourselves for who we are. Or maybe we could turn that around. We'll never see ourselves for who we are until we see Jesus for who he is. So as we look at this story, these three stories really this morning, what we're going to find out is that Christ only gives himself to those who see themselves as he sees them. So we want Christ to give himself to us. We want Christ to do for us what he doesn't do for the Pharisees in the very next story that we didn't read. But right after the feeding of the 4,000, Jesus goes back across the lake, lands on the shore, and he's greeted by a bunch of Pharisees, the same ones who have been viewing themselves as pretty good. As Jesus gets on the shore, they ask him a question. Not really a question, they ask him for something. They say, will you give us a sign from heaven? Not this miracle stuff, like something from heaven. Fire, manna. Really, really flex your spiritual muscles so we really know that you're from God. And Jesus looks at them after sighing and says, you know what? No sign is going to be given to this generation. He gets back in the boat and he sails away. He doesn't give them himself to them. He sails away. He walks away. He turns away. One of the saddest stories in all of the gospel. But that's not the story we have in these sections. In these sections, we have Jesus going beyond Palestine, where some are accepting, several aren't. Those who are at the center of the Palestine politics and religion are coming out to him and rejecting him. We're going to see that he's going to be crucified by Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians in just a little bit. But he leaves this region and he goes beyond. He goes into Gentile territory. He goes to a place that really he doesn't belong, and they don't belong to him. And yet, some do, because he gives himself to them. I guess the question then is, if Christ only gives himself to those who see themselves as he sees them, what does Christ look for in somebody so that he can give himself to them? As I'm coming to him in devotions in the morning, or I'm coming to him in prayer, as I'm coming to him in worship, what is God looking for in me that he might give himself to me? That he can be mine and I can be his? What does that look like? What is Jesus looking for? And as we work through these passages, we'll find three examples of the types of people to whom Jesus Christ gives himself. The first we find in verses 24 through 30. Jesus gives himself to the humble and the bold. And those two words can go together and do go together, especially in this story. As we start the story, we see that Jesus is going to take a different approach. He just gets done talking to the Pharisees, talking about what's clean, what's unclean, talking about religion, conservatism, standards, externals, measuring up. And Jesus then departs from that place, we see in chapter 7, verse 24. From there he arose and went away. This signals a decisive departure. This isn't just the ordinary Greek word for going away. It's a stronger Greek word. He purposefully chooses to separate himself from the place in which he found himself. And where does he go? He goes to a different place. Not Galilee, not Jerusalem. He goes to Tyre and Sidon. He goes north. He goes up to the coast. As we start working through just the geography of where this is, we see that what Jesus is doing is not separate from his ministry to the Jews. It's an extension of it. Edwards writes this: the mission to the Gentiles did not take place before or apart from his prior witness to Israel. Jesus has been ministering for some time. For the first half of this book, we've been watching his ministry, and it's been to Israel. The proclamation of the gospel now to the Gentiles is the fulfillment of the history of salvation that has begun in Israel. And Jesus is beginning to signal that, yes, he's come for Israel, but he's come for more than Israel. And in this one foray into Gentile regions, we see that he's getting away, and yet he's giving himself away at the same time. He goes to a different place. He goes to a different people. Now, this is really significant in light of what has just taken place in chapter 7, because he goes to a people that Jews, normal Jews, regular Jews, especially pious Jews, would consider an unclean people. So Josephus calls them our bitterest enemies. Again, Edwards writes, Tyre was probably represented the most extreme expression of paganism, both actually and symbolically, that a Jew could ever expect to encounter. Why would that be? Because not only are they an unclean people, but they're a condemned people. When we think of this region of Tyre and Sidon, one name should leap to our thoughts, to our imaginations, and that's the name Jezebel. Jezebel came from this region. If we were to go back to Matthew chapter 15, we would read that the gospel writer there, Matthew, calls this woman not a Syrophoenician, but a Canaanite. The same Canaanites that were under the ban. The same Canaanites that God said to wipe out so that they don't mix with your people. The same Canaanites that in the flesh represented sin. And God said, don't let them mix sin with you. Take care of them. Drive them away. Put them under the ban because I put them under my judgment. These are the people that Jesus goes to. One writer says, of all the people who approach Jesus in the Gospel of Mark, this individual has the most against her from a Jewish perspective. Look at verse 26. He says, this verse reads like a crescendo of demerit. First, she's a woman. Second, she's a Greek or a Gentile. Third, she's from the infamous pagans of Syria, Phoenicia. Fourth, her child is demon-possessed. Unclean, 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 unclean. And yet Jesus goes purposefully into this region. There's similar problems, though. Even though it's a different region, there's similar problems. A woman comes to him whose daughter has a demon possession. And as all mothers would do, she goes to Jesus. We see that as Jesus goes there, verse 24, he did not want anyone to know. And yet he could not be hidden. And she comes and she cries and she calls. In fact, it seems as though she's been doing it for some time, because in Matthew 15, the parallel account of this, the disciples come to Jesus and say, tell her to go away. She keeps crying out. She won't let us go. She won't leave us alone. Get rid of her, Jesus. There's the same problems. There's similar attention. She hears of him, verse 25. She comes to him. She falls down at his feet. Go back to Matthew chapter 15, if you would. Matthew 15, because it's important for us to get this story locked in our imaginations. Matthew 15, verse 21, Jesus went away from there in Upper Galilee and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon, and behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying. Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. Now look at verse 23. But he did not answer her a word. And the disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, because she continues to cry after us. And Jesus doesn't talk to the woman, he talks to his disciples. He answers them, guys, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she won't go away. Instead, she comes and kneels before him and says, Lord, help me. And then we have the same conversation that we see in the book of Mark. Jesus speaks to her and says, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And she answers him, Lord, yes, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And then verse 28 we don't have in Mark, but it's important. And Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. As the interaction begins to take place, Jesus is silent. This mom who's beside herself over the wretched plight of her daughter. We don't know exactly what it looks like, but you can imagine. As the demon seeks to destroy her body, mind, soul, spirit, this mother is beside herself, distraught to say the least. But she goes where she knows there's an answer, and there's only one answer to be had. Jesus, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. Heal my daughter. Listen to me. And Jesus doesn't answer her. Does that resonate with you? Do you feel her burden at this point? She's under a weight. And the weight isn't even just for herself. She has a mother's heart, and her mother's heart is broken, and she's coming to Jesus, and she's pouring out her heart, not quietly. Jesus, would you please hear me? She's crying out, Jesus, you got to hear me. Help me. And Jesus stays silent. What would you think of Jesus at that point? He's indifferent. He doesn't care. But Jesus has a bigger purpose in mind at this point. Jesus is going to celebrate her faith. Jesus wants to bring that faith to the surface so that everybody down throughout history can understand what faith looks like. Because when Jesus is silent, the woman does not become silent. She keeps calling out to the only one that she knows will have an answer. My friend, have you ever been there? As you feel this woman's pain, you go to Jesus. I must tell Jesus. I can't bear these burdens alone. Jesus, hear me. And heaven's silent. In my distress, he quickly will answer, the song says. I read that and chuckled. You ever gone to him and he doesn't quickly answer? So what do you do? Well, what do most people do? Guess he doesn't care. Must care about everybody else but me. Or maybe he's not all that good. Your mind ever go there? She doesn't go there. She says, he won't answer, but I won't stop. And she keeps crying out, and she keeps crying out, and she keeps crying out. And she gives the simplest of prayers. Finally, when it's all said and done, she's on her knees before Jesus, and she prays the same prayer that Peter prays as he's drowning. Lord, help! You gotta help me! There's silence, but it doesn't silence her. There's diversion, but she's not diverted. Guys, I need to go to Israel. Jesus, I need you. I need you. I know you're concerned about others, and I'm thankful for that. I need you. I need you to be for me who you are. I need you. So Jesus turns to her. And there's a challenge. Again, we're back in Mark chapter 7. And we see there in verse 27, and he speaks to her and says, let the children be fed first, for it's not right to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs. This is rightly one of the most difficult sayings of Jesus in Scripture. Because as you listen to it, what does Jesus call her? A dog. That's not very politically correct. Let's crawl into the heart of this and find out what's going on here. Jesus, again, doesn't do this to discourage her. Jesus' purpose isn't to call her out as unclean. Remember, we just had that story with the Pharisees and the disciples. The disciples are eating with unclean hands. They're unwashed. And Jesus says, listen, you don't know their heart. How can you judge them by the condition of their hands? Besides, it's not what goes in that makes you dirty anyway. It's what comes out of you that makes you unclean. It doesn't have to go in. It started there in the first place. As Jesus uses this term, dog, he's not condemning her because of her condition. That she's a Gentile, that she's a Syrophoenician, that she's a woman. He's not even condemning her for the fact that her daughter is demon-possessed. That's not the point. The term isn't as ugly as it sounds. He uses a diminutive. It's not so much dog as it is puppies, notably a house pet. Now, when we think of dogs, we think of dogs as pets. That's what we normally think of. But in the culture, the day and age in which Jesus lived, dogs were not normally house pets. There were some, but they weren't normally. The normal dog was a scavenger. He was a street mongrel. He was a mutt. And he would be there to eat up garbage. He would be there to eat up carrion. He would be there to make a mess all around the town, and you'd have to avoid dogs because sometimes they traveled in packs and they were dangerous. So often when the word dog is used, it's talking about the mangy, scurvy mongrel that's around the corner that you want your children to avoid. That's not the term that Jesus uses here, because Jesus puts this dog inside the house. And the woman picks up on that. These terms then are embraced by the woman. She says, "Yes, Lord. But even if I'm a dog, and I'll accept my place as such, even if I'm a puppy, don't the puppies get the scraps that fall from the tables of the table of the children from their master's hand? Don't the puppies at least get that?" She understands that there's more to being a child than simply being born into a family. Listen again to what Edward says about this passage. He says, "The issue at stake between Jesus and this woman is whether Jesus is sent to the children or he's sent to the dogs. Whereas Jesus refers to Israel as technon, which are biological children, this woman refers to Israel as paideon. This is a more inclusive term that implies both children and even servants in the household. This change in terminology suggests that the woman understands God's mercies extend beyond just those who are ethnically born into that people group. She says, "Lord, I understand that your people are the recipients of your blessing, but there's an overflow that spills out to those who belong in your house as well." And with this, we see that as Jesus goes to a different area with a different approach, he receives a different reception. This interaction clarifies the faith of the woman. Within this parable, we see that she's wrestling with Jesus. She takes his words and she enters into the parable, putting herself inside of it, and she uses her words, or she uses Jesus' words, not against him, but to counter him and say, "Okay, let's use your metaphor, let's use your parable, let's use your terminology. Isn't it true, using your illustration, that dogs, that puppies inside the house can still eat from the table of the children, anything that falls off the table?" She enters into that metaphor, and she starts wrestling with Jesus. And I love how this one writer says, within this parable, she's met a living Lord with whom she now struggles and contends. In fact, we see that she is a female Jacob. She's wrestling with this God, striving to find in him the only answer available for her deep, deep need. She's struggling. She's persisting. And this interaction not only clarifies her faith, but it reveals her heart. Keller has this in his book. I'm going to read this at length, but listen to what he says. "Despite such obstacles, this woman's heart is true, even if her credentials are wrong. She appears to understand the purpose of Israel's Messiah better than Israel does. Her pluck and persistence are a testimony to her trust in the sufficiency and the surplus of Jesus. His provision for the disciples in Israel will be abundant enough to provide for one such as herself." What an irony. Jesus seeks desperately to teach his chosen disciples, yet they're dull and uncomprehending. Jesus is reluctant even to speak to this walk-on pagan woman. Yet after one sentence, she understands his mission and receives his unambiguous commendation. How is this possible? The answer is that this woman is the first person in Mark to hear and understand a parable of Jesus. That she answers Jesus from within the parable, that is, in the terms by which Jesus addresses her, indicates that she's the first person in the gospel to hear the word of Jesus to her. And in the end, not only does Jesus give her what she asks for, but he says, "Your faith is amazing." A That's awesome. That's exactly what I've been looking for. And Jesus strings her along, if we can use that term, not in a bad way, but he draws forth from her an illustration of what faith is supposed to look like. Who does Christ give himself to? He gives himself to someone who's humble enough to understand, I don't deserve this. And never in this story does she intimate, you've got to give me this because I deserve this. These are my rights as a Syrophoenician. These are my rights, being from Tyre. No rights. You've got to do this for me, not because I deserve it, but because you're the only one who can. And Jesus does. She's bold. She's humble. Number two, we see that Christ gives himself to the hurting and the helpless. Verses 31 through 37, we have the story of a deaf man, both deaf and mute. I want us to note the method as Jesus comes to this deaf man. Now, you ever thought, which would you rather be, blind or deaf? You ever thought about that? I think I was talking with one of the girls in the car the other day. One said, I would rather be, and the other said, I would rather be. Which would you rather be, blind or deaf? Deaf? Why? Yeah, you can see so much. I mean, so much of life is done by sight, right? I never thought about this perspective. This handicap is indeed terrible. If given the choice between blindness and deafness, the idea of losing our hearing doesn't seem nearly as debilitating as losing our sight. But medical authorities and the deaf themselves say otherwise. Terrible as blindness is, the blind do not suffer the social pain and stigma experienced by the deaf. The gawking, the impatient stares of those who are not aware of one's condition. When somebody's blind, there's usually a visual clue, hey, this person doesn't get it. They don't look anywhere, but you can talk to them and their head doesn't turn. Okay? But when someone's deaf, you expect them at least to give you some assent. They don't. When they're deaf, they can't necessarily talk. They can't put those sounds together, so it sounds like, well, they sound like a mumbling idiot, right? So they might have the IQ of you and me, but because they don't respond to stimuli, and when they do respond, it sounds like, this person isn't very intelligent. We'll take care of you, right? So when you stop and think about what this man has been suffering for years and years, and then you look at what Jesus does for him. Look at it again. Verse 31, he returns from the region of Tyre, comes down to the region of the Decapolis, still a Gentile region. Verse 32, and they bring to him a man who's deaf and has a speech impediment. That's going to be an important word. And they beg Jesus to lay his hands on him. So Jesus takes him aside from the crowd privately. He's been kind of a gazing stock for a long time. He's been made fun of. Jesus pulls him off by himself. And he puts his fingers in his ears. Putting his fingers in his ears doesn't do anything. Jesus is prepping him for what's about to happen. But here's the thing. Jesus touches him. He enters into his life. He pulls him aside and he touches him. Then he spits. And we're not told where he spits. If he spits on something, in something, at something, he spits. But I can picture Jesus going, Jesus touches his tongue. Jesus comes up close, gives him an indication of what he's going to do, and then he looks up to heaven. He says, now listen. And Jesus sighs. Just the facial expression. Just the deep heaving, the rising of the breast, and the relaxation. Jesus enters into the struggle of this man. And at this moment, I can see a tear dribbling down his cheek. This guy gets it.
He knows what I've been struggling with all my life. He can't even talk. And yet he knows that Jesus gets it. You ever, I think Mike, in Sunday school, somebody came to you this week and they were talking to you and you said, I think they just wanted somebody to talk to. They just wanted somebody to talk to. Have you ever just wanted somebody to talk to? Somebody who would just understand, not provide a solution, guys, not provide a solution. Just to understand. Jesus enters into this man's life. He says, oh, problems, right? Oh, yeah. And then Jesus does one word. Be opened. And like that, man's ears are opened. And like that, it says the chain of his tongue was loosed. That bondage was broken. It was severed. Why does Jesus follow these steps? He enters into the man's experience. He visibly communicates with him, and he proves that this man's condition moves him. But what's the meaning of this? Jesus comes and he heals a Gentile guy, but we're given a lot of detail about how he does this. He works through a process and he enters into the struggle that this man experiences. One of the things we have to see is, we said that this word up in verse 32, the speech impediment, it's a special word. It's used one time in the New Testament and it's used one time in the Old Testament in the Greek. That means in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. The only other place this word is found is in Isaiah chapter 35, which we read this morning. Look in your bulletins again. You got the passage printed out for you. I've got it somewhere. Isaiah 35, down in verse 5. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. This is the same word, this special word. Now, get this. Mark is writing probably to Roman believers. So quoting from the Old Testament really doesn't build his case in a lot of ways. But every once in a while, he will quote from the Old Testament, and when he does it intentionally, and he's building something big. This is one of those big building blocks that Mark is building into this text. The allusion then to Isaiah 35 is of huge significance in illustrating who this Jesus is. Because when Jesus looses the tongue of this, and the special word that's used here is magalilos. Magalilos. When he looses the tongue of this one with this speech impediment, he is the one who not only looses the tongue of the mute, opens the eyes of the blind, opens the ears of the deaf, but he is the one who brings water to the parched. He is the one that brings song to the downtrodden. He is the one who provides the way in which to walk. He is the one who will bring the vindication of God on his people. His people. His people who don't only include the Jews, but also includes the Gentiles. And here's the thing. This isn't just the arrival of the day of the Lord in the deserts of the wastelands, but these are the wastelands of Lebanon. These are the regions of Tyre and Sidon, precisely the Lebanon of Isaiah 35. Jesus' healing of this particular magalalos is the Decapolis, becomes the first fruits of his fulfillment of Isaiah 35. That Gentile Lebanon will join those who enter into Zion with singing. Aren't you thankful that Christ gives himself to the hurting and the helpless? Have you ever been hurting and helpless? Isaiah, or Psalm chapter 86, David's praying. He says, God, bend down to me because I am poor and needy. God, I got nothing, and that's why I need you to come to me. The last example of the kind of person that Jesus Christ gives himself to, we find in chapter 8, verses 1 through 10, the feeding of the 4,000. We see that Jesus gives himself to the hungry and the weary. Now, this is a different story than the feeding of the 4,000. We see that there's a different setting. In the feeding of the 5,000, there's green grass. In this region, in this story, there's no grass. It happens at a different time. With the feeding of the 5,000, they'd been with Jesus for one day. Here they've been with Jesus for 3 days. In the feeding of the 5,000, there's obviously five. Here there's only 4,000. There's different resources, 5 loaves and 2 fish. Here there's 7 loaves and a few fish. There's different leftovers. In the feeding of the 5,000, there's 12 small baskets full of leftovers. Here there's 7 baskets full, but the baskets are huge. In fact, they're big enough for a man to be. Think of a clothes hamper. It's the basket that they let Paul down over the wall in Damascus. These are different stories altogether. But here's probably the most significant difference. The feeding of the 5,000 happens in the company of Jews. The feeding of the 4,000 happens in the Decapolis, in the region of primarily Gentiles. Same story. Jesus blesses, breaks, he gives it out. And the particular wording of this in verse 1, chapter 8. In those days, while he's still in the Decapolis, it connects it very close to this region. It doesn't say he's in the Decapolis, but it says it's the same time that he was there. So while he's still there, this is what happens. They've been with him for 3 days. Here's a group of people that are physically hungry, but they're more than physically hungry. They've given up food. They've given up houses. They've given up beds so that they can be with Jesus. They're with him for 3 days. And again, Mark uses a special word for being with Jesus, remaining with Jesus. The crowd is not coincidentally present, but intentionally with him. This is an unusually positive description of a crowd in Mark. Again, Jesus finds a reception among the Gentiles that he's not found among the Jews. These people are hungry, not just for the miracles of Jesus, but for the words of Jesus. And they're not going to go away. They want to hear him. They want to know what he has to say. He's speaking still like no other man. He's gracious like no other man. He's got wisdom. He's got patience. He's got kindness. And they're hungry. They're hungry for him. It's been 3 days. This is meant to convey a different feeding, but it's meant to convey the same message as the feeding of the 5,000. Remember when the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus pulls his disciples away. They just got done with ministry. The crowd comes, and Mark makes note of this. And Jesus saw them, and what happened? Jesus sees the crowd, and he had compassion, right? Jesus had compassion. Well, look at verse 2. Jesus turns to his disciples and says, guys, I have compassion on this crowd. When you think of compassion, you think of mom, Syrophoenician mom, a young daughter screaming, tearing at herself, tearing clothes off of herself, throwing herself into fire, water. We don't know exactly what it looked like. We know what it looked like in other people. You think of a mother's heart being broken and wrenched. Okay, that's the word. It's gut-wrenching feeling for these people. We can see that when it comes to a mother. We can see that when Jesus feels that for the Jews. But often we see it In fact, most often we see this word used in Mark of people you wouldn't expect Jesus to have gut-wrenching compassion over. Jesus has gut-wrenching compassion over a leper.
Oh.
And it's not, oh, it's, oh. Jesus has gut-wrenching compassion for a deaf mute. Oh. Jesus has gut-wrenching compassion for outsiders and Gentiles. Oh. Jesus says, why do I want to feed these people? Because I love these people. I hurt with these people. These people are hungry. These people are like sheep that don't have a shepherd. I want to fill their need. Jesus feels your need. Can you sink that in? Let that sink in for just a minute. You've been frustrated this week. You've been tired. You must tell Jesus, and you have. And what's changed? What's changed in your thinking? Were you convinced that Jesus feels your need? But he brings us all the way through the story. Verse 7, they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these two should be set before them. Verse 8, and they ate and what? They were filled. They were satisfied. In fact, we see exactly what's happening here. Go back to chapter 7, the story from the Syrophoenician lady, verse 28. Yes, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. The idea is they've had their fill and it spills over. They've had their fill and it's spilled over. Jesus is wanting to fill up the Gentiles in the same way that he wanted to fill up the Jews in the feeding of the 5,000. In fact, the Greek of verse 4 might better be translated, who is able in this remote region to satisfy these people with bread? Who? Who can do it, Jesus? And the whole point of the narrative is that Jesus can satisfy the people. Only Jesus. Only Jesus. Only Jesus. My friend, Christ only gives himself to those who see themselves as he sees them. Let me ask you this morning, how do you see yourself? Are you humble? Are you bold? Are you hungry? Are you weary? Are you hurting? Are you helpless? Because here's the thing. If you see yourself as small enough to need Jesus, then you'll find that Jesus is big enough to meet your needs as he gives himself to you. But Jesus doesn't give himself to those who don't believe they need him or don't believe that he won't give himself to them. For those who believe him must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who what? Diligently seek him.